Broadcast, and if I've set everything up all right, we are now live on Radio EduTalk. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening live. If you're not, just hello. This is John Johnson on Radio EduTalk, and I'm really pleased to introduce tonight our guest, Will Tuft.
Hello.
Hi, Will. And I guess, yeah, maybe you could tell us a wee bit about your background before we get into the topic tonight, is the immersive classroom. And I think immersive in the ways I hadn't thought of before, but maybe you could just tell us a bit about your background, how you got to where you are and where you are now.
Yeah, no problem. I qualified, what, 8-9 years ago now? I think it was about 9, actually, in fact. I've taught most of my career in England. I did my NQT year, my probationary year in Plymouth, where I trained as well, and then moved out to Australia and taught primary school, taught a bit of secondary school, was a professional rugby coach out there for a bit on the sly, and then came back to the glamorous location of Slough, just outside London, which was interesting part of the world, and then I worked there for 5 years in a selective grammar school, which at the current time is obviously one of those things that everyone is talking about in England. So I finished there last summer when my wife got a job in Edinburgh, and then moved with her up here, and I've just been kind of plodding around at the moment, doing some freelance resource making, and secured a temporary contract over at Liberton High School for a good majority of the rest of the year. I'm a geography specialist, but I've taught all manner of things. My degree's in English as well, so I've taught quite a lot of English, done a bit of PE, taught a bit of dance, all the usual ones people get roped into when they're not looking and they just agree to stuff on a whim. For the last 2 years, I've been a more able coordinator for my last school. So that was a lot of regional stuff and organising like regional teach meets and that kind of stuff in the local area. And then, scooted up here and just delighted to be back in the classroom as of 2 days ago.
Right, okay. So that kind of, I'm surprised you've got any energy left at 8 p.m. because I know the compression going back into the classroom is quite tough.
Yeah.
And I met you, Will, at the recent sort of Pettigrew Muckle event in Glasgow. And in the middle of that event, there was a I suppose they called it a mini teach meet. And it was very much a stand up and talk for 2 minutes. No slides, no resources. And you were talking about this immersive classroom. And it was really fascinating. And obviously 2 minutes was not enough time to explore it at all. I was particularly fascinated in where it came from and where it went. Now, the immersive classroom sounds as if it's underwater, and perhaps to some extent it will be, but we just, could you maybe just introduce the topic and talk a wee bit about the immersive classroom as you understand it and you use the term?
Yeah, I don't know if it's I've kind of looked it up a bit, and I don't think it's a proper term. It's used a lot in the theatre industry, when they discuss immersive theatre, which, if anyone's heard of a company called Punch Drunk, they do things where you're kind of in immersive theatre, you're part, the audience is part of the story, they're part of the play, part of the production, and I saw that. One of my good friends took me along to see it wasn't a Punch Drunk, but it was a similar company, and I'll be honest, I hated it. It wasn't my cup of tea, because I'm not a massive fan of being involved in those kind of things, just in case someone jumps out from behind a corner and scares you, or you have to go and sing on stage or something terrible like that, which is my idea of hell. But I came away from it thinking the premise was pretty cool, and I did some digging around, and I remembered a lesson I'd seen links to and resources for by a couple of guys down at in an international school in Toulouse called it was Russell Tarr, who's does the history stuff, massive fan of his work, and Matt Pobre does a lot of the geography stuff down there. I think they're I think Russell is at a different school now, possibly. I think Matt might be as well, but they've done something along with Alan Parkinson, who I've become Twitter friends with over the years, and I've written some stuff for some publications he's written, and they planned something around the Iceman discoveries, OTSI. Alan had written a book on it, and they set up an entire laboratory, effectively, based around this crime, well, this crime scene, inverted commas, a discovery of the Iceman. And I thought about that a little bit, and they'd kind of, they'd dressed up a little bit, and it was they'd set out part of the lesson as a kind of a little a cordoned off zone. I thought about that after the punch drunk thing, and thought, actually, I think I can go further than that. I think I can develop that idea a little bit and go full bore on it and really explore it a little bit. So I came back and started thinking about how I could sort out lessons, individual lessons, strands of lessons, maybe whole schemes of work based around things, and started by doing little bit by little bit. Some of the ideas were a bit weird. The first one I did was actually, I didn't call it immersive, I just called it an experience lesson, an event lesson. I always tried to get observed when I was doing them to make sure that it wasn't just me thinking it was a great idea and me wittering on for ages and ages. I always got either my head apartment or one of the deputy heads to come and observe me.
That's a fascinating idea, actually, for people who are trying things out. And we quite often talk to people on EduTalk who try things out, but I've never heard somebody say, you know, the first time I try something out, I'm going to be observed. That's really interesting.
I think it's a hangover from my training, I think, because my mentor when I was training never left the room, and I was, for a good period of time, I was really worried about, oh god, he's never leaving. Like, I must be doing something really, really wrong. I asked him about it. He said, oh no, I've got nowhere better to be. Yeah. And it brought down to the fact he actually was quite enjoying the lessons, and he quite liked stealing some ideas and stuff. Yeah. And it didn't completely numb me, but it kind of got me engaged with how useful observations be, and they're a tool to, okay, they can be a tool for worrying, a tool for kind of hanging around people's necks and stuff, but they're actually really useful, particularly if you get people whose opinions you very much respect and colleagues who've got a particular expertise in a certain area. And I always found my boss in my last job was very supportive of me in that regard. If I said, oh, do you want to come and observe this? I've got an idea. He'd be delighted to come along and just plod around the back of the room and make some notes and say, oh, I'm not sure about this bit, not sure about that bit. But I started rolling them out bit by bit. I started with the Northern Lights experience. But I tried to, because we were a bit short of budget at the time, I tried to just use what I had lying around. So I found an old OHP, and there's a way you can set up, I found it on an American website, actually, it's a primary school website, where you can set up an OHP with coloured acetate, and you effectively put the lid down, so it's not really projecting anywhere. And then right above the OHP, you can move the acetate around, it looks like the passing of the Northern Lights in different colours. Which was a really, really silly idea. I just thought, oh, it's a bit throwaway. And then I developed it a bit more and thought about, actually, I'm going to teach. It was a year eight class at the time, a bunch of 13-year-olds who had to select geography as an option in year eight. So I was trying to promote the subject as much as possible, being a bit different and a bit odd. And then got them to do all a load of theory and the science of the Northern Lights and that kind of stuff. And then we turned all the lights off and just had the Northern Lights above us. And we all sat on the floor, lied down in some cases, and then individual pupils would present and be a tour guide for the Northern Lights. So that was the kind of start point for it. And then I just built up from there. And that was probably a 10, 15 minute part of a lesson. And then I built up. So it became a whole lesson. Then it became a couple of lessons. So it got to the point where I was just kind of planning three wedges of lessons with a completely trashed classroom because I'd organise everything to look like a hurricane zone or something similar.
Right. I think there's quite a big jump from putting a few lights in the ceiling and pretending the Northern Lights to trashing your classroom. So maybe you could expand a little on the classroom bit before. And again, I'm surprised you had anybody observe that.
that was actually quite fun to have observed. But yeah, it kind of incrementally got bigger and bigger. So the next one, I set out. I didn't really do much to the room, but I left all the. It was in the middle of winter, and we always tried to be as topical with the weather as possible. Mm-hmm. So we studied Antarctica in the middle of winter because it was that little bit chilly, and you could get a bit more focus on it. And there was the odd little bit of snow here and there. But I left all the windows and doors open and told all the class for the next lesson to bring in gloves, hat, big ski jacket. And kind of got lucky on the weather a little bit. I kind of was hoping it would be horrible, like really chilly, lovely, crisp, chilly day. Left all the windows and doors open for. Luckily, it was a pretty easy day, so I I think I had a free period before it, so I just had about 2 hours of the wind rushing through the room. And then I'd got a small fluffy seal, a little, like, it was about, I don't know, about 12, 13 inches in size. And then I staged a CSI crime scene of the death of a seal in the middle of the room, and got the kids to examine a load of evidence that I put around the room. And it was a kind of like a proper crime scene of little footprints going places. But they had to wear their ski jackets and their gloves and their mitts and their hats the entire time, because they were in Antarctica, and they had to specifically refer to that, to the scenarios they had in front of them. Just to really engage them with, we were studying food webs, and yeah, food webs as a concept it's not the most interesting in the world, if I'm honest. So just trying to get them thinking about food webs and thinking about, okay, so, well, why would they kill this animal? Why might this animal kill it? And I gave them loads of suspects. I roped in a couple of friends who had come in as hunters to randomly walk through the classroom at a given moment to point out what hunters were doing in the area.
So these friends just appeared in the classroom and walked through.
Yeah, did. They just walked through, and then I think they were carrying a couple of dead seals on their backs, other little furry seals.
Yeah.
It's amazing what you can get off your little sister when she's moving home. It's quite good.
Babies
slaughtered. Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, they just walked through, and they were there. We'd like bloodied them up a little bit to look a bit beaten up and stuff. And then they just walked through. It was only a couple of kids who noticed what they were doing, and they were all big, they were all in coats as well. They said, "Sir, have they got seals as well?" "Yeah. Does that help us? How can that help us in any way?" And it was all about getting them to think about what was going on around them, rather than just as a bit of paper in front of you. Because I could have given all of that information on a piece of paper and just said, "Right, who killed the seal?" In a lovely warm classroom.
Yeah, but were they taking notes in this classroom with their gloves on? And
yeah, notes, answering questions. They were allowed to take the gloves off, but then they realised it was actually pretty chilly, so they'd answer one of the questions, then quickly whack them back on again, move to the next task, or find the next piece of evidence that they could establish. And they were allowed specific roles as well, so they came in, and I differentiated the roles a little bit. I kind of gone away from that a little bit now. I've let it be a bit more laissez-faire in terms of the roles. Factors, but yeah, they came in with specific roles, whether it be they were focusing on the motive or they were focusing on the suspects, and they all collated back together as a group, and then figured out as a group who had actually committed the crime, and then they submitted. That one was actually quite nice, because it was done via a QR code reader. Mm-hmm. So they scanned a QR code reader, and that took them to a Google form. Sorry, it wasn't a Google form at the time, it was attached to Weebly. It was on the Weebly website. I made a website up and just said, right, you submit your guess there and your rationale. And the team who won, because it invariably, weirdly, only ever one team got it completely spot on. And that's with, 3 or 4 years of doing that same task. And they all got little police badges as prizes. But it was very much that kind of getting in amongst it.
So was it the polar bear?
No, it was actually the killer whale. The polar bear was it was all about it was all a bit of a smoke screen with one of the animals. So it led you down one route, and then when you actually looked at it a bit closer, it was very obviously another one, but it was all a bit of a smoke screen halfway through. I spent far too much time planning that. It was outrageous. Yeah. But that is one of the negative sides of doing kind of big scale stuff, is that it does take.
Sure. You're saying you've done this 3 times.
Oh no, these are just the 3 ones I've just kind of. I probably do an event style lesson. I try and get one for every topic, for every year group I teach.
But I'm thinking that the fact that you've done this particular, I'm presuming you meant you've done this particular one a few times.
Oh right,
What sort of effect does? I mean, you obviously find it has a positive effect on the pupils.
Yeah, it was interesting, because with that one, it was quite useful, because we aligned with science, so that when we knew there was some crossover with the sciences, when we studied tectonics, we made sure that in chemistry they were studying rock cycle and that kind of stuff at the same time. When we were doing food webs, we made sure that in biology they were studying food webs and biodiversity and ecosystems as well. So there was quite a lot of crossover, which was quite nice, and it was, I think, the best feedback about from one of those sessions I've got was actually from a science teacher who said that they came to the lesson they were going to study on food webs and just knew everything. because they were completely on point about what the food web was, what the structure was like, what happens where the arrows go if they're drawing a food web, all that kind of stuff. That it was embedded within the lesson, but it's one of those things that I can test and test and test, but I quite like crossover skills.
Sure.
And it was nice to hear a teacher, a biology teacher, say that, because a couple of weeks later, saying, yeah, there's a real definitive skill there. We've kind of merged it perfectly between the two subjects, which probably doesn't happen enough actually in secondary schools to try and link up as much as like between the subjects. I think Scotland's actually better for it than England, in fairness.
Well, I think it's quite a hard, I mean, I'm a primary school teacher, so I tend to do it at least a little, but you're in a good position to do it because you've got the same children all day and you can let things run over and merge a lot easier. But in secondary school, I guess timetabling and all that sort of stuff has got to be fitted into your plan.
Yeah, it did take a bit of organisation, and that was, we were quite lucky because we had quite a stable department, so we kind of knew month to month, year to year, where we were going for at least the next 18 months to a year, 2 years. Whereas it's not as always easy.
So you're actually, because when you introduce them, you know, you say, we trashed the classroom, or, you know, we left all the windows open. And at that point, it sounds as if, oh, we came in one morning and thought, well, let's just make the place look like a hurricane. But obviously, there's a deal of planning and preparation goes into this.
Yeah, so some of them are a bit on the fly. Some of them are kind of, I might teach a lesson before the day before and just then that night have a bit of a plod around with some ideas. Some of them, like the hurricane one, because it was a bit of a stretch of lessons, that took some planning, partly because I had to book out other rooms and do some other bits and bobs linked to it, so get some different equipment and that kind of thing. But some of them would take even longer. So I set one up, which was about field sketching, which was putting blackout curtains on all the walls. Blackout curtains, it was whiteout curtains effectively, like massive pieces of muslin on each of the walls, and then having a projector firing a different part of the same image on each of the walls. Mm-hmm. So it pretty much gave them like a 360 of a view. It was actually the Alps. We were studying mountain tourism, and they could choose. I took all the chairs out and tables out and put them either to the side or out in the outside my room, just for a spell. And then that one took ages because I had to get all the projectors hooked up. I had to book out the projectors, which were ones that no one was using. They were old ones, but I had then get the tablets out, which we were very lucky to have at that time. Tablets, make sure the images were aligned, set all that up. And that was for effectively a controlled assessment skill within another topic. So I was looking to do it for field work, but the kids weren't the best at it. So I wanted to practice a little bit and linked it in with another topic. But that took... must be about 2 or 3 weeks of solid organising, setting up, and that's the kind of negative side of it.
I think that's when you hear about this, it sounds really exciting, but then you begin to think, well, if I was going to make my classroom look like a hurricane, where would I start? And how would I keep it, you know, it's that sort of scenario, I guess, that it's quite easy that pupils will get very excited, and it's keeping them on task and things like that.
Definitely. There's obviously some pupils who really engage with it and enjoy it for the level of intrigue and the level of interest. And I think it's interesting to see sometimes that pupils appreciate the effort that you or whoever you put into the creating the effect. There are some, there always are, that just kind of go, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever, kind of like almost like headless chicken kind of attitude. But actually, a lot of that is when you go about doing it in either a unit or in the course of a year. It's not something I'd whip out too early if I just met a class or I wasn't too sure about what was going on with individuals in the class. I'd want to get a really good idea so I could personalize it as much as possible, because even within just trashing or like ruining a classroom, there's quite a lot of personalization in there. A lot of it was set up, and a lot of the tasks and the stuff I used in the lesson changed depending on the class I was doing it with. So I think in a 1 year 10 class, one class was excellent on the theoretical notions of hurricanes, but they're really poor on the specific detail. So I made more of the tasks and more of the kind of the lessons link to specific detail of Typhoon Haiyan rather than with the other class, where it was more about the theory and the kind of the command words and how to attack hurricane style questions rather than just regurgitate everything they know about a hurricane, or in this case Typhoon Haiyan. I think it does make a difference when you do it and what stage of the year you're at and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think there's always going to be pupils probably who try and take the mick. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of that is having a decent relationship and them appreciating that you've gone to the effort of trying to make their lessons as interesting as possible. A bit of reciprocal, I can't even say it, but reciprocal nature of it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to try. I've murdered far too many words in radio as you talk to. To try so the word that means give and take, I think. I've got maybe dig into one lesson in a wee bit more detail in a minute, but one of the things you're doing is, I guess, asking the children to suspend disbelief.
Yeah.
Because of the theatrical nature of it.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. And this, I remember, and this, I'm going back over, well over 20 years, when I had started teaching in Glasgow and I was doing supply, and there was a primary two, and the topic, which I can't remember, was something about a cat.
Right.
But the deal was that you told the children, who, you know, are six, that we were getting a cat.
Oh, blimey.
And after a wee while, this, up in a top high cupboard, they see a wee basket and there's a wee cat appears. And, you know, the cat goes through all sorts of adventures and you have this cat and they do all this. It was a writing topic, I think, and they did all this writing around a cat. And, like, some of the children at some points believed that they were getting a cat. And I always felt slightly guilty about this. I mean, it was a really good topic, but I felt slightly guilty.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
I'm guessing you don't have that problem. But it's the same sort of idea, is that...
Yeah. It is. It is a little bit of kind of the imagination side of things, because I was thinking where this, like, where this, these kind of lessons could go, and I was talking to some people from Google about their Google Expedition stuff, like the virtual reality, and I really like that idea. But in some ways, I quite like the fact that it's not particularly high tech in, like, me changing a classroom around or just opening the doors, whatever, because it yeah, I kind of like the fact they've got to use their imagination a little bit and got to believe that they're doing this and got to think that they're visiting a disaster zone or they're like assessing a Pompeii destruction, like something like that, rather than literally seeing it. I like the fact that I like reading. I've always liked books. I've always liked text. And I like the idea that you can make up your own images and what you think it's going to look like a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you can compare it to reality, if you want to later on or if you need to for any particular reason. Rather than the kind of VR stuff, which is, right, this is the image of what we're going to looking at. And you can't really, I don't know how far it's going to go, the VR stuff, but I can't really see much interaction with it. You're kind of seeing it. That's fantastic.
I mean, when I'm listening, I had the Google people out in the school the week before last. You know, they brought a set of Androids and the glasses, and the kids all put them on. And to tell you the truth, I was more interested in just seeing how the technology worked. And it's certainly the pupils were really engaged and, you know, were pointing at things.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. But listening to you there, I'm wondering if it could be something like, when you've got this situation, so you're in the Arctic.
That'd be amazing.
But you could be in an igloo.
Yeah.
And when the glasses go on, you're going out to find things out and then you're coming back to discuss them in the igloo so that you can take it off. And I guess if the classroom doors are open, that would add a heck of a lot of reality to the situation. Or, you know, on the moon and you come back to the lander after looking outside. That'd
be great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Maybe combining the two would be better than just being completely in the virtual reality.
Yeah, I think that's great, because we tried to make some last year. We did successfully make some the Google Glass glasses stuff, the VR headsets, and it was really good fun. But yeah, we had the same thing. It was, we had 15-year-olds looking around. I think it was St. Paul's or something like that. Mm-hmm. And just pointing at stuff with these, walking around the room, pointing at things. And it was an RS teacher was using it, and because he'd come down to observe one of my lessons and quite liked the idea, and took it back up to his place. And he was saying that they really benefited from seeing the features, but he thought that it wouldn't be as good if it was like it'd be almost better if you could see it, like if it was a webcam version, like a real time version. Mm-hmm. That'd be amazing. You could literally just walk into, I don't know, you could walk into what Victoria Falls is doing right now and look around and see what's happening, rather than a still image, which is what the majority, not all of them are, but the majority at the moment.
The ones we looked at certainly were. They were just an image you were put inside.
Yeah.
But, you know, to actually do, be able to move around live, I think you would need a bit more technology than a phone and a cardboard box.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they were quite effective for looking around and quite absorbing. But I think what was missing for what we were doing, which was just really trying it out, and then we picked a few things that we're talking about roughly in the classroom, but we weren't, you know, we're really interested in just seeing what it was like. And I think that if we put in the stuff you're talking about round about it, it would maybe be a much more powerful effect.
Yeah, definitely. That'd be great.
Yeah. It also means if you were in the igloo, then people could go out two at a time, so you would need a set of 32 glasses if you have a big big class.
Nice cost effective strategy.
Yeah. And then maybe, I don't know if you want to take the Hurricane one or another one and just give us maybe a flavour of a couple of the tasks
that
Joan did, and what the purpose was, you know, the sort of what you thought they were getting out of it, really.
The Hurricane one's probably the most obvious one to go through. I did it with year 10 class. It was a GCSE class. And there was six tasks around the room. Some of them were clear up tasks, so literally help clear up the hurricane environment. And one of the tasks actually hidden under a pile of like rubble kind of stuff, but it was like a pile of chairs and some bits of paper and stuff. One of the tasks was hidden under there, so they had to literally help the clean up. And then when it came down to it later on, we discussed, well, which tasks did you actually do without even realizing it? And it took a little bit of probing, but they worked out over time that actually we were part of the relief effort, because we were helping clear up that kind of stuff. And there were some of those kind of embedded tasks that weren't explicit in any way, shape or form, which was good to talk about afterwards, after the event, like the lessons after it. There was individual tasks, there was mapping tasks. So I'd left out some maps of the area that were kind of all dog-eared and kind of half ripped and stuff. And they had to do some basic analysis of how far they were from landfall, how far they were from the nearest certain features. It was a bit of map reading, map exercise work, because it was an area they were struggling with. There was other information. It was a bit of a bodge job, but I'd set up one of our department tablets with a loop of a news report from a nearby town to the landfall, and then they had to go and watch the clip and then identify as many effects as they possibly could do in that area. Then for the stronger candidates, I'd start thinking about, well, are they social, environmental, economic effects? So that was in one corner. You had the pile in another corner. There was debris strewn all over the place. There was a bit of graphing. They had to, I didn't cut them actually. They were already pre-cut out, but some little cardboard people. And then they had to graph the cardboard people, each different coloured cardboard person represented a different colour, different thing, different section of the population. So then they talk about who was most affected. Was it the poor? Was it the rich? That kind of stuff. All the time I was monitoring around the room. So I was talking to them, having conversations, but trying to play it. I was in a dust suit as well, and a hazmat mask thing. So I was trying to play the role as much as possible, and kind of I'd given them a time frame so they knew that when all the fans died, they had an X amount of time to get out of the room before the hurricane hit up, but picked up again. So there was lots of things going on. It was it was incredibly busy at the time, and that was kind of the first lesson that I did it with them.
So the fans were providing a wind.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and an annoyance for a lot of them, which is quite good.
Yeah.
Any sort of movements, I had to fixed point fans and set those up. So that was just finding ones in which the caretaker had left over that he wasn't using anymore. So I just went and borrowed those for a couple of hours and whacked those in the corner. But it was a very much a kind of a car boot sale of things I'd found and bits that are kind of half broken. I got a couple of bookcases that were broken that were just kind of sat in the corner that I chucked over and chucked some books on the floor and stuff, and set up some like small bits of large bits of cardboard that look like roofs of buildings that had been blown away, that kind of stuff. And it was a lot of it was describing that they, one of the tasks when they went in, we stopped straight away and I made all the pupils describe what they saw, describe the debris, and like kind of emotive words they came out with. I just jotted them down, and then we referred back to them over the next couple of lessons.
I mean, it sounds fascinating. And this, you said that being observed, you've got good feedback from that. The sort of feedback the pupils gave you. Did you get feedback?
I was quite lucky in the school I worked at in Slough. The pupils were very switched on to how teaching worked. And they were very appreciative of how a lesson structure might happen and how the lesson might flow or formulate over a period of time. So the feedback was really interesting because the pupils identified, without me explicitly telling them that they were focusing on this aspect, they were focused on the specific detail. They came out and said, "Oh, well, I feel my specific details got better, and my detail and my answers." The debrief to the rescue effort was actually, we sat down in a separate room, in a debrief room, and we had one 8-mark question, and they had to answer the 8-mark question using the information they'd just been through and worked through. And the specific detail was way better because they were kind of visualizing it a little bit. It was that kind of like dual coding idea of seeing something visually as well as textually. And that was really positive. And it was nice because I think most of them went home and told their parents, because the next parents evening, I had parents asking me about it, and what did you do that for? What was the purpose behind it? Like, you can do anything like that again. Like, my son's in year seven, you can do anything in year seven, yeah. That kind of stuff. But it was really positive. And I think that was quite a weak class in terms of, relatively speaking, for the school, it was quite a weak class. And seeing the progress they made with a couple they did, and I think they ended up doing three different kind of immersive things in the year and a half as a class I taught them. And then that they kind of just fed it through, and they seemed to really enjoy it, and they really got on board with it, which is really nice.
I did notice, I mean, it was a very short time, I guess, to judge, but one of the things you were talking about was getting children to choose geography as a subject.
I don't know. I think a lot of those kids I taught for a while, so they were in year 10 at the point, so they'd already chosen. The kids lower down, because that school chose their other options in year 8, so it was quite early. But since doing it, it was interesting which lessons they mentioned. If you talk to them at parents' evening, you said, "Oh, what do you think you're doing well in geography?" And they'd either say, "Oh, I was really good at the tour guiding for Northern Lights," or "I was really good at the CSI stuff." And they would always kind of refer back to those big lessons. Yeah. It was really interesting. I could have done some research into it, really, but whether that meant it was to the detriment of other lessons, I don't know.
I mean, the whole idea sounds really fascinating, and it sounds as if you could do it in other subjects as well, I guess.
Definitely.
You could probably do some sort of history.
Because I think things like that exist. Yeah, I was thinking battles and that kind of stuff, yeah.
But it seems a really good way to engage children, and you seem to have managed to get focus while you've been engaged on specific, you know, to bring up specific skills or specific questions and things. So that sounds fantastic. Well, so we said I think we'd run about half an hour, and we have done. I don't know if there's anything else you want to add before we wrap up a wee bit.
Not what I can think of. No.
I think it sounds great, and I hope we hear that you're going to bring this once you've settled in. It's 2 days in. It's a bit early to start throwing waves around a classroom or whatever. But I hope you can continue to develop this and we hear about it. And you're on Twitter at the real W Tuft. We'll put that in the show notes as well. And you've got a blog, which is always nice.
I've got to update that a little bit, but yeah, it's ticking along.
Which is geotuft, and it's geotuft.wordpress.com, and it looks like you've got a good set of resources and
thinking about bits and bobs
around geography, which even as a primary school teacher, picking up ideas and things from, so it's great stuff. Thank you very much. So I think it's all I've got to do is say thanks for giving up the time, Will.
Pleasure.
I think the idea sounds as if it has legs, and I hope some other geographers take it up. I'll be certainly thinking a wee bit about it in the primary classroom, although I think I won't tell lies about cats anymore. I'll leave that in the far distant past. But you know, obviously at primary school you can think of these sort of ideas fading in a wee bit, and getting some buy-in and all the rest of it from the pupils. So thank you for stimulating my imagination as well as your pupils' imagination, Will. And if you're listening live, to say you can contact, or if you're listening to podcast, you can contact Will on Twitter, I'm sure, to ask questions about that. And I'll hang up now, so I'll just say goodnight, folks, to the people out there. Cheers.